That, ladies and gentlemen, is Buddy Guy, one of the kings of Chicago blues. My guest for this entire hour, and we'll be talking next week, too, on the stage at the Logan Center from 5 to 5:30. Paul Netkin, that's hardly enough time for us.
Just enough to get started.
You know what I'll do? I'll bring a tape of this and say, here, just listen to this. Paul, I have known Paul for 30, maybe close to 40 years. He is the chronicler of not just Chicago music, but international music. And what has always intrigued me about Paul, because it makes him sort of like me, he learned and was imbued with this by his dad, who was a terribly, terribly talented photographer, who at one point, Paul, he gave up photography to raise you.
He gave up photography because of me.
Yeah, you and your brother.
I was born.
You and your brother.
And my mother told him that he couldn't be traveling all the time, so he quit photography and became a builder.
And a good builder. He was doing sort of solar stuff before it became...
Before anybody knew what it was.
Before it became the rage.
Yep.
But he did, later in his career, go back to... picked up a camera again.
The building business went kind of down the drain, and he couldn't make a living, and he became a house husband for a while. My mother went out and got a job for the first time in my lifetime, and he was cooking dinner and washing dishes and all that stuff, and he decided to pick up a camera after 20 years.
Wow. And after that, he got a pretty good job, a steady gig, as we say in the freelance
business. Well, it wasn't
business.
A good job. It was an interesting job. He called a friend of his that was working as a publicist for the Chicago Bulls basketball team and got hired as the Bulls team photographer.
That now, I suppose, to everybody out there is going, oh, my God, what a dream job. This is pre-Jordan.
It was way pre-Jordan, but it was also, there was no money in it.
Yeah.
But that's how I got into photography. He came home from his first game, and he told me three things. Number one, free parking. Number two, free meal in the press box.
Free food, yeah.
Free food, good hot meal. And number three, best seats in the house.
Yeah. How old were you?
And I was 20.
What were you doing?
I was... not doing much of anything.
Yeah,
I was going to UIC with having a different major every quarter.
Yeah,
I was staying out of the draft is what I was doing.
Sure.
Not have to go to Vietnam. And all of a sudden, I said to him, like, okay, you got to teach me how to take pictures. I got to go to a Bulls game.
Wow.
And the first time I ever held a camera in my hand, I was standing courtside next to the guy who became Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
It
was still Lou Alcindor at the time.
Oh.
And I'm out on the court standing next to this guy who was 2 feet taller than me.
Were you immediately hooked?
I was immediately hooked on...
the free food and the free
the free games and all that. But I was immediately hooked on the fact that you could just push a button and hopefully come up with something that was art.
Yeah. What did your father tell you philosophically about... photography? I mean, he didn't just say, here, Paul, point this at someone who's on the court and press a button and it'll be great.
He pretty much said, point this at somebody on the court and press a button. And then,
well, you must have been a natural then.
Pull this little lever, and when he can't pull it anymore, give me the camera and I'll put another roll of film in.
Wow.
And it's where I learned anticipation.
Yeah.
It's where I learned there's a thing in photography called the decisive moment.
Sure.
Which is...
was that Capra's phrase?
It was Cartier-Bresson.
That's right, that's right.
Had this phrase, the decisive moment, which meant that in any given event, there's one decisive moment.
Yeah.
And you have to be ready to capture that.
Mm. Mm.
And, you know, there's always one moment in a Bulls game. In later years, it was Jordan dunking.
Yeah, yeah.
But in those days, it was, you know, Lou Alcindor, it was Will Chamberlain. It was
Elgin Baylor,
Bernard King, Oscar Robertson.
Sure.
And seeing those guys play, and there was always something that they did that you had to capture.
That must have been astonishingly good training, though you didn't know it.
It was great. It was great. The thing that made it easier is that once the game started, the light never changed.
Oh, interesting.
It wasn't like going to a Bulls game or going to a concert where the light is different every 30 seconds.
Yeah.
Once they turn the lights on, they're on for good.
Do you think when your father watched you for a time taking pictures and would obviously critique your style and your artfulness, did you think that he thought, and in retrospect, wow, maybe my son's going to become a photographer?
We had a very odd relationship. not the greatest relationship. And his idea of photography, street photography, which is what he was.
He also was very good at that.
He would go out with a camera. He'd find somebody that he'd want to photograph, and he would sit down and talk to them and spend 15 minutes with them, learning about their life. And then he'd say, can I take your picture?
Yeah.
And he'd take their picture, and then he'd go home, develop the film. He'd make a print, and he'd go back and find these people and give them a print, like, the next week.
Wow. And some of these people were in, you know, disenfranchised neighborhoods. He wasn't going to Lakeshore Drive. He wasn't generally taking pictures of women coming out of Saks Fifth Avenue.
The story is, in 1950, a year before I was born, he was hired by the Chicago Housing Authority to photograph all the worst ghettos in the city of Chicago.
Because to justify them.
To justify them tearing everything down and building housing projects.
These beautiful, horrible high-rises. Wow.
So in the 70s, when he got back into photography, after he got the job with the Bulls and decided he wanted to become a photographer again, he wanted to go back to those neighborhoods and figure out, you know, what had become of that.
Yeah.
That great experiment. Which,
yeah, horrible experiment.
Which was not a good experiment.
Yeah, bad idea. His name was Robert Natkin. We will be back in a couple minutes with his son, the eminent photographer, Paul Natkin. Paul Natkin has a number of books out, some of them done in collaboration with our great mutual friend, David Hoekstra, who used to have a show on this very station, who's an incredibly talented writer. Paul and I are going to be at the Logan Center, at the third Logan Blues Fest, which is next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Just go to, it's very easy to find out all the stuff they're doing, logancenterblues.org. As part of that is what I cannot wait to see, as much as I want to talk to Paul next Saturday night from 5 to 5:30, is an exhibition of your blues photos. How many photos, Paul?
25 photos that encompass my entire blues career.
Wow. Are most of those Chicago-based shots?
Almost all of them were taken here in Chicago. A lot of them were taken for album covers or album projects. A lot of them in concert. I got to be really good friends in the beginning with Muddy Waters, with Willie Dixon, with Buddy Guy. And still friends with Buddy Guy to this day.
Sure, sure.
And
What about Coco Taylor? Any Coco?
She came over to my house a couple times.
Yeah, I loved her.
Hung out together a lot.
I'll never forget Charles Osgood, my photographer. We went to do a story about her. We went to her house, and she lets us in, and she excuses herself because she has to do the laundry. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a minute, you're the most famous female blues singer in the world.
And she has to do the laundry.
She has to do the laundry. You have gotten those kind of incredible insights into the real lives.
I once went to Detroit to do a photo shoot with Bob Seger.
Yeah.
And he was a half hour late because his wife made him install their new dryer.
It's not all million-dollar rock people.
No.
When did you make the transition? It was, I guess it would have been maybe the early 80s, maybe to rock and roll.
It was earlier than that. It was I was shooting sports around Chicago, shooting basketball.
Were you making a living doing
it?
No, okay.
Wasn't making any money. I had no idea how to make money. But I liked doing it.
Yeah.
And I started shooting tennis. And I was shooting like every great tennis player from the 70s and 80s. I photographed everybody from McEnroe and Connors to Chris Evert to Billie Jean King.
Oh,
wow. And one day I was shooting a tennis match up at Northwestern. And I parked next to this building called Kahn Auditorium.
You told me this story a long time ago. It was Bonnie Raitt, right?
Yeah. And I got done with the tennis match, and I turned on the engine of my car, and the radio was on. And they said Bonnie Raitt was playing 5 feet away from where I was parked at the moment.
Free parking.
Still free parking. And I shut off the engine. I got out my camera equipment, and I just decided to BS my way into the concert.
Wow.
And I went to the backstage door, and I made up this whole story about how I was a photographer assigned by Rolling Stone magazine, which was a brand new magazine in those days.
Yeah, sure, sure, sure.
And the guard at the back door just looked at me and said, "Oh, you're with the press. Just go in and do whatever you want. Just don't get on stage."
Wow.
And that was the first concert I ever shot in my life.
Wow.
It's like 1976.
You were, I am assuming at the time, as the early 20-something, you were in love with music.
I always liked music. Yeah. I always liked blues. I always liked any kind of roots music, country,
sure,
blues, folk. My mother used to listen to a show on WFMT called The Midnight Special.
Oh, God.
Every Saturday night.
Sure.
And
sure,
she let me stay up till midnight to listen to it.
How great is that?
And then they started playing blues when Muddy Waters played at Newport.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
all of a sudden there was blues creeping into the Midnight Special. And I started going to clubs and seeing Muddy and seeing Howlin' Wolf. And back when I wasn't old enough to get in.
Well, those were interesting. In that day, those clubs were predominantly black clubs. I've heard stories from young people from the suburbs, like the young Corky Siegel and the young,
right,
Jim Schwall and the young Mike Bloomfield and the young Paul Butterfield. They were welcomed into these places. If they loved the music, and especially if they could play it, they were welcomed. And I'm sure you were. Were you too?
Yeah, I wasn't taking pictures or anything. I was just there as a fan.
Yeah.
But yeah. Nobody ever bothered me.
Yeah, I think
I took the L down to the checkerboard once, and I got off at 43rd in Indiana.
Sure.
And I'm waiting for the bus, and a squad car pulled up, and two African-American cops got out and said, "What are you doing here?" And they insisted on driving me to the checkerboard and letting me off in front.
Wow.
And then
wow,
they told me how to get home without having to take the L.
Yeah. How interesting. But I think that's a real, I think, and I've heard that Corky is very poetic about his time.
Oh, yeah. I was just at his house a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy. But your stories and his talk about a Chicago that was a much better, to my mind.
Much more homogenous.
Yeah.
Is that the right word?
And a much more accepting.
Yep.
And a much more... So you took pictures. You took pictures of Bonnie Raitt. What did you do with those pictures?
Put them in a drawer.
Yeah,
I had no idea how to pursue doing it for a career.
Yeah,
but there was a new place that opened up on Clark Street called the Ivanhoe Theater.
Sure,
and I went to a show, brought my cameras, figuring I'll just like BS my way in there.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a guy at the back door that I ended up becoming really good friends with that started letting me into shows all the time.
Oh.
And in return, I would give him prints.
Wow.
And one day he said...
Just like your dad did with some of the people he met out there. Yeah,
yeah. So one day he called the manager of the Ivanhoe over and said, "You know, this guy's a great photographer," which I was terrible in those days. I mean, I'm embarrassed by those pictures. And he said, "We should just give him a staff pass and let him come here anytime he wants."
Oh, how great.
And that was the first break I got.
Yeah.
And then...
It was in the days when Ivanhoe was doing theater, right?
No, it was all concerts.
Was it all concerts
I shot
then?
Dolly Parton, Kenny Rogers, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Wow.
Many people that I've never even heard of and have never heard of since.
Yeah.
But then this guy that was working the back door called his boss, who owned a company called Jam Productions.
Arnie or Jerry.
I think it was Arnie at the time, one of the two guys, and said, "Hey, we should let this guy into all of our shows."
What was the name of that guy?
Scotty Gelman.
Oh, I knew Scotty.
Yeah.
I knew Scotty. Because I was checkered years in my... past, they said, "Hey, how old are you?" Elliot Wald had just quit being the rock critic for the Daily News and had gone to New York. And they said, "Rick, do you know anything about music?" And I said, "I stopped listening to music when the Beatles broke up." And they said, "You're the new rock critic." I was the worst rock critic for 2 years at the Sun-Times. The worst. Unimaginably bad.
Unimaginably. And then McLeese came in.
Yeah. I helped that happen.
Yeah.
And Don was a great critic. So that's what really... But then, when does it occur to you that, well, I can get in all these concerts free, and I can take all these pictures, and maybe I can make a living.
It really never occurred to me until one day.
That's one of the reasons I love you.
One day I was at Park West, and I was standing in the lobby before the show, and this woman I knew came up to me and said, "Hey, I want to introduce you to somebody." And it was the photo editor of a magazine called Cream Magazine.
Sure.
Which is a famous rock and roll magazine. And this guy, Charlie Oringer, was the photo editor. And he said, "Well, you know, if you're as good as you say you are, call me the middle of the month every month. I'll give you a list of who we're doing articles about. And just send me pictures. And if we like them, we'll use them."
This is one of the, ladies and gentlemen, I hope you're listening, this is one of the most remarkable stories I've heard about.
Oh, it gets much better.
Oh, I'm sure it does. Yeah, if we don't get to it all tonight, then come next Saturday night to the Logan Center Blues Fest. There's a lot of stuff going on at this thing, so just go to...
It's three nights of really great concerts and us.
Seminars and the two of us for a half hour.
Yeah.
And Paul Cho, too. The center is at 915 East 60th Street in Hyde Park.
It's right on the University of Chicago
campus. And it's a beautiful building. It's a beautiful, beautiful building. Go to LoganCenterBlues.org. We got to get a news in here, and then we'll be back to hear more stories from Paul Natkin. When Paul Natkin's book is published sometime later this year, early next year, called Paul Natkin, The Moment of Truth, I'm going to have him on for an entire month. We'll do it'll be 8 hours or 10 hours, because it's just not enough time to cover. We'll be talking some more on Saturday night from 5 to 5:30 at the Logan Center Blues Fest, which really has a lot of cool things going on. Before we get back to Paul's own career, this is a great, this is an incredible lineup.
It's a very well curated 3-day festival. The first day is sons and daughters of famous blues artists.
Mm.
So it's like the next generation.
Yeah.
And there's some really, Shamika Copeland is one of the greatest singers.
No kidding.
On the planet.
No kidding.
Ronnie Baker Brooks, Lonnie Brooks' son. He's a great guitar player, great performer. Lurie Bell is the son of Carrie Bell, who was Muddy Waters' harmonica player. Steve Bell, who's playing with him, was also Carrie's son. It's a really great show. And then the night that we're there, Bobby Rush is, we're opening for Bobby Rush, basically. And he's like 86 years old and still going strong.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I have to mention on the Sunday night, there's a woman that's the opening act. Her name is Melody Angel. And
what a great name.
She was born on the south side of Chicago. Her uncle was Otis Rush.
Oh, wow.
She is, I call her the Angela Davis of Chicago, of the 21st century.
Mm.
She's a very active member of Black Lives Matter, very literate, great songwriter. She has a giant afro, just like Angela Davis.
Yeah, yeah.
Great singer, great guitar player. She sings like Janis Joplin and plays guitar like Jimi Hendrix. And
wow.
She's great.
Wow. See, that's one thing, you know, as the newspapers lack sort of the staff that we once had that would go out to various places and tell the general public about these kind of secret things going on. I still try to do that as best I can, but I feel like a lone person. What was a big moment for you, Paul Natkin, in your photography career after you got Jam Productions allowing you into shows?
Well, I spent several years just shooting whatever. Anybody that walked out on stage, I was there taking pictures of them.
Yeah.
And I built up a huge collection of work. And then in June of 1987, I think it was. I'm pretty sure that's when it was. I have to think about that for a second. I got a call from a publicist in New York who said, "Do you want to go up to Minneapolis and shoot Prince's birthday party?"
Wow.
It was at the club that Purple Rain was filmed in.
Yeah.
And it was the week before Purple Rain came out. So I went up there thinking, okay, I'm going to pay $100 for a round-trip plane ticket.
Mm-hmm.
Minneapolis. I'll get a room at the Red Roof Inn out by the airport. Maybe I can make the money back.
Mm.
And I got up there and found out that I was the only photographer that was allowed in the building.
Wow.
I still to this day have no idea why that was.
Mm.
And
must have been quite a night.
I stood right in front of Prince and shot pictures for 2 hours while he performed in all the costumes that he wore in the movie with the band from the movie, which is the first time they ever played live in front of an audience. And then he went into seclusion for 6 months, and I was the only person in the world that had pictures of him looking like he did in the movie. So then 2 weeks later, I get a call from another publicist who worked with this guy by the name of Bruce Springsteen. And she had seen my Prince pictures and said, hey, do you want to go back up to Minneapolis and shoot the opening dates of the Born in the USA tour?
And well, I said, sure, no problem. Maybe I'm busy, yeah.
And then she said, well, come up a day early and meet me at the hotel. And I got up there, met her at the hotel. We got in her rental car. We went to the arena, and Bruce was shooting his first video ever for the song Dancing in the Dark,
which featured
Courtney Cox dancing with him. I was the only one in there with a camera. Had total access to it for like 8 hours. And Rolling Stone liked all those pictures of Prince and Springsteen. So a week later, they called and said, hey, can you go down to Kansas City and shoot the opening two nights of the Jackson 5's Victory Tour?
Good God.
Which I did. So within a one-month period of time, I shot Prince, Springsteen, and the Jackson 5. And I became, I guess, nationally known.
Pictures went
everywhere, and all of a sudden, I could write my own ticket. Anybody I wanted to photograph, I just made a phone call, and boom, done.
But where would they? Cream was one thing. Rolling Stone, I'm assuming.
Rock and Roll magazine, Parade magazine.
The list
of magazines is endless. Ebony, Newsweek. I shot Springsteen in 1984. Up in Minneapolis. I came back to Chicago after shooting three shows up there. And a couple days later, he played at Alpine Valley. I went up there and shot two nights there. And then a year later, he went from playing arenas to playing football stadiums.
Yeah.
And I got a call from Newsweek, and they said, hey, you know, we're looking for pictures of Bruce. We're doing a big article about him. So I sent them a bunch of pictures, thinking maybe I'll make a couple $100. And a week later, I had the cover of Newsweek.
Which is
one of the biggest things that any photographer could have happen.
No question.
And because of that, this is kind of an odd segue, but because of that, I was asked to be on a TV show, morning TV show in Chicago called AM Chicago.
Sure.
The host was this woman named Oprah Winfrey.
So when Oprah had taken over.
Yeah, which she wasn't even there when I was on the show. She was filming The Color Purple at the time. But I went on the show. Don McLeese was also on the show. It was called Brushes with Bruce. And he had just gone to Washington to interview Bruce about, not to interview him, but to review his first stadium show.
Wow.
And we did this show the morning of the day that they played at Soldier Field. And the show was really embarrassing. I sat there for an hour on live TV and said absolutely nothing. But as I was leaving, somebody walked up to me and handed me a business card, which I just put in my pocket and didn't even pay any attention to, and said, hey, you know, give me your card. If we ever need a photographer, we'll give you a call. And I got home, and I took this card out of my wallet, and it's for the executive producer of this show that was coming up, called The Oprah Winfrey Show.
Yeah.
And they called me up a week before the show started and said, do you know anybody that might want to be the photographer for our show?
And he said, let me think for a minute.
A deal with them where I could own the copyright to all the pictures.
Wow.
And
so
I spent 5 years with Oprah Winfrey.
Every day?
Not every day.
Yeah.
I did all the shows that were quote-unquote publicizable.
Uh-huh.
So if it was a celebrity,
yeah,
I was there.
Yeah.
If it was a weird, interesting topic where there might be like people yelling at each other,
sure,
I was there.
Were you still doing concerts during that time?
Yeah, because that was in the morning. It was live at 9 o'clock in the morning.
Was it a good job for you? I mean, it obviously gave you a solid foundation.
It started out to be, and, you know, I made a deal that I owned the copyright to all the pictures. And, you know, the first year I shot Eddie Murphy, Schwarzenegger, Stallone, Elizabeth Taylor, Jimmy and Rosalind Carter, Liberace, you know, and I still have all those pictures.
What an eclectic gathering. Yeah.
Well, it's just whoever was hot that week.
And then there was later a to-do about the rights and
there was a legal battle over the rights to the pictures, which, you know.
You got.
I own all the pictures. They're all at my house.
Do you ever, Paul, do you ever go through your files and sort of take trips back in time?
Well, about 5 years ago, I started digitizing all my film.
Yeah.
And during the pandemic, I had a lot of free time.
Sure, sure.
And when I started digitizing, I started with the first drawer, which is ABBA. Starts with ABBA. And about a year into the pandemic, I hit ZZ Top.
Wow.
And so I went through every folder in the files over the last 5 years.
Are there millions of photos?
4,500 artists that I shot. And some of them I shot once. And
many times.
Some of them I shot 50 times.
You seem to me, and I love photography, but I know nothing about it. You seem to me to be drawn to active acts as opposed to even a great, you know, someone like Steve Goodman was pretty active. A guitar player sitting in a chair on a stage.
It's really tough to shoot that.
Yeah, but I mean, costumes and wild hair and wildness.
I was one of the top photographers for the hair metal era of the 80s.
Yeah.
Which was all hairspray and spandex and bright yellow stretch pants and lots of lights. But I enjoy the challenge of photographing James Taylor and making him look exciting.
Yeah.
You know?
We got to take another break and come back and we'll finish off. I'm serious, when Paul's book is out and it's called Paul Natkin, The Moment of Truth, as he was talking about earlier in this hour, I'm going to have him on for an entire month and tell stories. I'm serious. This is like, it's fascinating to me. I was peripherally involved. My brother was a road manager for a lot of different acts for a while.
I worked with him once.
I know. Mark managed, you know, when you manage Elvis and Frank Sinatra, you've got some.
Unfortunately, I worked with him with Styx.
Oh, God, when they did that tour. Yeah. Oh, my God. Mark's a good guy. He's out of the rock and roll business. We'll be back in a couple minutes and finish off this hour, the first of many hours I will spend with Paul Natkin. I have only a few minutes left with Paul Natkin, but as I've promised you listeners, he'll be back for an entire month. We're going to do like at least 8 hours of this. Paul, you were talking about, you mentioning all the amazing people who are going to be next weekend, you and I among them, not so amazing, at the Logan Center Blues Fest, the children of some of the great blues artists and a couple ancient blues artists. Tell me, what do you consider now the state of the blues?
Well, the blues world is getting older.
Yeah.
And it's now gotten to the point where the young people are now in their 40s and 50s.
Yep.
And kids are just not into it.
Yeah.
Because they could go and buy two turntables and scratch a rap song and make $1 million.
Yeah.
They don't have to practice their guitar 8 hours a day to learn how to
play in basements. That's an interesting story. That's a sad.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm trying to get the world to see that there's still some great stuff out there.
Well, obviously, if you go to the website, ladies and gentlemen, go to the website, logancenterblues.org, and I think you'll be intrigued enough to go down to Hyde Park and go to the Logan Center. I mean, it's an amazing lineup. It's also, you get to see, I'm sure you're enamored of Paul Natkin now, you'll get to see an exhibition of his blues portraits. I'm looking at six of them, and they're just stunning.
By the way, it's only $10 to get into any of these shows.
Oh, my God. Well, that's one of the things about the Logan
Center. Ours is free.
Of course, as well it should be.
Yeah.
As well it should be, because I'll give everybody the website of this show, and they can listen to it later. What are you doing these days, Paul? I mean, you're not obviously the pandemic slows down the.
Well, even before the pandemic, I slowed down considerably because the world of music became very strict about allowing people to take pictures.
Why?
Everybody wants to control their own image, yeah. And the best way they could do it is to have their brother take pictures of them with an iPhone,
mm-hmm.
and use those for publicity shots.
Yeah.
And or if they have enough money, they hire somebody like me to go and shoot a couple shows, and then they give the pictures to all the magazines for free, because they then can
control
which pictures get out there.
Control the image.
So to have some random guy show up with a camera, even if they're told that the guy's trustworthy and doesn't send out bad pictures, is beyond what they're expecting.
Mm.
So they come up with all these rules. Like, rule number one is you can only shoot the first three songs.
Wow.
Then you have to leave the building.
Mm.
Then the next rule they came up with is you have to shoot from the soundboard.
Oh, come on.
Which, wow. Not only is it too far away, but it's also the wrong angle.
Yeah.
And number three, they then make you sign a contract saying that you could only sell pictures to one publication, which you have to list.
Wow.
And then you have to turn over all the pictures to them, and they own all the pictures.
Oh, that's horrible.
And my career is based on licensing photographs that I've taken over the last 40 years.
Yeah.
And if I then have to put a note in my file saying I could never sell these pictures to anybody, it's no point. If I sell it to one publication, I probably don't even make enough money to pay for my parking.
Ugh.
Or gas.
And from the old days when you had, for you and your dad had free parking.
Right, exactly.
It has been, Paul Netkin, and I've observed it from afar and admired it from afar, a really remarkable career. Paul's got a cool website, too, Netkin.net, N-A-T-K-I-N.net. There's also, through the LoganCenterBlues.org, you can buy prints through this that go, the proceeds of which go to an organization that helps young musicians.
It's an organization called Guitars Over Guns.
Yeah.
And they go into schools on the south and west sides and do after-school programs and teach kids how to play music and how to form bands and write songs and perform.
And stay out of trouble.
And stay out of trouble.
Paul Netkin, you know how much I've admired you over these. I've known you for 40 years. And
same really, back at you.
Yeah, you ain't kidding. And Mark, I should have had my brother on. He's in town for a while. You will be on, again, Krista, you can vouch for this. He will be on for an entire month sometime, just telling story after story. Come see us both next Saturday night from 5 to 5:30 at the Logan Center on East 60th Street.
You have to reserve a ticket ahead of time online.
Go online. You know how to go online. LoganCenterBlues.org and Netkin.net. I will not see you next week, but I'll be back the Sunday after that for a half hour to say goodbye to Roger Badish, newsman extraordinaire. Take care. Be safe.